Carol, how
Good.
are you?
I'm fine, and it's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, can you
Well,
hear my voice clear?
I can hear you very clearly. I hope you can hear me.
It's a little bit soft, but so maybe you can speak a little bit louder, or I can change my equipment.
Let me see how does this sound?
Yeah, this is
That's good.
fine.
Okay, terrific.
Hey
Well,
Carl,
yeah.
at what time you got up this morning?
Well, it's 10 o'clock now. I usually get up at 5 in the morning.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Why?
Because what one of my Scotties, one of my dogs, wakes me up.
Okay.
Otherwise, I probably would sleep longer.
Yeah. That explains a lot because I saw your email just before 12 here.
Yes.
Yeah, that's 6 hours. So I thought, oh, well, it's before 6 in the morning.
Yes. Yeah. Now our listeners will know why this happens.
Oh, are we live now or what?
Well, we're recording. And
Okay.
it's up to you. I can edit out this part, although it might amuse some people.
I don't care.
Okay.
It's your bet.
All right. Okay. Well, welcome to my podcast,
Yeah.
A Life in Biography. It was suggested that I interview you by Gabriella Marie Kelly Davies. Now,
Yes.
I didn't really need her to suggest that. I should have interviewed you already. So I have to start the podcast with an apology.
That's
At
not
any rate,
necessary.
okay, here you are. Before we do anything more, I know that some listeners know exactly who you are, but for those who don't, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a Dutch biographer, and I'm trying to make the Biography Institute at the University in Groningen to make a success. So I'm supervisor of quite a few dissertations that are at the same time biographies. And if you bring the biography to the university, you need a theoretical framework, and I guess that's exactly where we are talking about today. Because, like building in a house, you need scaffolding. The question is only, do you leave the scaffolding after you put the roof on the house? So theory and a theoretical framework for a biography is very important for me. I published two biographies of Dutch poets, and next year I will publish, together with the co-author, a biography of Theo van Doesburg. That's the man next to Mondrian.
Aha. So you're both a theoretician and a practitioner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to show off, I'm reviewing a biography for a national newspaper here in Holland, and I have a monthly radio show about biography.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's good to know. And do you do it in English or in Dutch?
No, in Dutch.
Okay. It's a language I still have to master.
Yeah, like I have to master English better than.
You're doing fine. You're doing very well. The thing that Gabriella wanted us to talk about is the role of interpretation in biography.
Yeah.
And gave a number of examples of biographers who have addressed this issue. One, she quotes Charlotte Jacobs, who says, biographers must take a stand. So, is that what you do when you do a biography? Do you take a stand?
Yes, but such a sentence sounds a little bit ambiguous, because I think every good biography is based on a historical fundament, and you can call that the facts or the possibilities of the facts. And if the fundament is solid, you need interpretation. In fact, I don't like those biographies without interpretation. We are not writing entries for Wikipedia.
Right. No, I agree. I guess it depends on, and partly I think this is a matter of taste, partly it's a matter of theory, the extent to which the biographer interprets or takes a stand. I know in my biographies, it varies from subject to subject as to how much I do that. When you compose a narrative, in a sense, implicit in the narrative, you're making selections. Is some kind of theory or judgment or a view of the subject. To tell the story is also to some extent to interpret or understand the story. But I guess the question is, does the biographer do more than that? Should the biographer be a sort of character in the narrative?
No, I prefer to see the biographer as the invisible hand in a book. And just as you say, in choosing sources, in the way you are working, the way you are writing, there is already a lot of personal things in it. But I don't like the I form, so that the biographer introduces himself as a person. I always think when I read these things, oh, nice for you. It makes it, in fact, very impersonal.
Well, let's do a concrete example here. You may not have read this book, but I'll describe it to you. It's a book that I have reviewed that's out in the current issue of New Criterion. It's a biography of W.G. Sebald. And the biographer in this biography of Sebald is very much present in the biography. She interviewed him, she talks about what it was like to interview him. She talks about her research and the way she interviewed people and whether she trusted them. What do you think of that approach?
It is possible. I know the biographies of Richard Holmes.
Yes.
He's doing the same, but he's an exception. He's such a good writer. And there are so many biographers who think they are Richard Holmes. So sometimes it's possible. I read also a wonderful book of Pierre Assouline. It's about an hotel in Paris. It's called Hotel Lutetia. And it's all based on facts, but he introduced one fictional character, and that's the gérant of the hotel. As you know, the gérant, he knows all the secrets of the guests of the hotel. So he's seeing Peggy Guggenheim and Charles de Gaulle are coming into, and some ministers, they have their mistress there. So then it has a real function. And everyone knows, okay, this is an invented character. And Richard Holmes, to come back to him, what he is doing is very interesting because he is, in fact, although he's writing about himself, but in fact, he is commenting the biographer.
Yes,
And he is so often misunderstood because some people like Richard Holmes because of his literary form. And there are a lot of quotes for that. But Holmes, in his biographies, explains very well dreaming in your sources can only take place after doing serious research in archives and collecting all the sources. And only after this field work, you can start to write and to dream in those sources. But as I said, Holmes is for me a real exception.
Yes, yeah. I think what you said earlier about, the quality of the writing and about some people thinking they can be Richard Holmes, but can't quite bring it off. Sometimes great writers can break all the rules.
Yeah.
And Holmes seems to be able to do that. The other thing I like about Holmes, too, in speaking of interpretation, is his use of footnotes. He has a narrative, but he has almost sometimes a kind of counter narrative in his notes to the book.
Yeah.
So that you get a kind of dialogue between the different aspects of the book.
I like this from the one hand, because if you are not interested in these things, you can just skip them.
That's true.
You can do that. And the good news is footnotes were always terrible for publishers, and they didn't want that. But since a few years, that means here in Holland, we had already a few biographies, very well-written biographies, with the footnotes on the page, like in scientific work. And why not? And the really good news is no one commented on that.
Wow.
So that's sometimes you have important news without anyone said something about it. And this is one of these things.
I think that's interesting, because people often think that if you put the notes right there on the page, you know, you have a narrative, and then that you can scan down to the bottom of the page and there's the note. It's a footnote. And some people feel that's really distracting. You know, put it in the back of the book. The problem with putting it in the back of the book is then you have to keep flipping back and forth between the two if you're really interested in the research.
I think it's quite simple. If you are reading a biography, it costs you 3, 4, 5 evenings to read such a book. I can't believe that someone who is spending all this time in one book, he's saying at the same time, oh, I don't care where this biographer got all this information. I just don't believe that. And history is giving me right, because more and more biographies are very serious. But here you see that language is something important. People like to speak about a scientific biography or a scholarly biography. Footnotes and references are only important for the scholarly justification of a biography. I don't know what a scholarly or an academic biography is. You have good biographies and poor biographies, like every book.
So, yeah, I agree with that. I think that it can sometimes be a problem. It's sometimes it's a matter of definition. I mean, what do you do with the term literary biography? Is a biography a literary biography because it's about a literary figure, or does it mean it's a biography that goes into considerable detail about the subject's literary work?
You were talking about interpretation.
Yeah.
If I may, I want to go back a moment for that.
Please, sure, yeah.
Because interpretation has something to do, what's the aim of your biography? And I guess most biography, so not all biographies, are about what did Shakespeare say? Reputation is the only part of someone's life that will survive. So a biographer, he's a kind of gatekeeper to someone's reputation. And if your aim is to write biography about a person, let's say from the 19th century, you have at least two choices. You can confess and confirm the reputation of someone, or you have the ambition to correct something. And I think that's in biography very important. We have so many biographies of one person. Examples are always the same: Stalin, Hitler, JFK, Roosevelt. And sometimes people ask him why. And that has something to do with the reputation. Of course, I know times are changing. We have other questions now than 20 years ago. Everything is changing. But at the end, it's all about reputation.
Yes, I think that's true. I was also thinking, as you were talking about words one might use along with interpretation. For instance, there's the biographer's motivation, and you were sort of getting at this. For instance, when I did my biography of Amy Lowell, there had been several biographies of Amy Lowell, but I felt they hadn't done justice to her. And although I didn't call the biography Justice to Amy Lowell, it was a work in the sense of a kind of restoration or rehabilitation. And I did call the biography Amy Lowell Anew, because I thought, you know, there's really a fresh way of looking at her. And yeah, clearly that deals with how I'm interpreting her life.
I think that's something that biographers don't like to hear, but biography is like a can of milk. After a few years, in the case of milk, after a few days, it's outdated.
Yeah, yeah.
And biographers like to say, oh, well, I'm writing a novel, it's for eternity.
Yes.
That's not true. If you have the choice and you go to the library and you see three biographies of Tolstoy, most people will pick out the most recent biography.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that, you know, I always call biography cumulative and incremental. And yeah, the reason you go to that newest biography is because biography is cumulative and incremental. You're probably going to learn something new or something different or a response maybe to the other biographies by looking at that new biography. Occasionally biographies last because the writing is just so damn good. But yeah, I agree with you, it's relatively rare. I mean, in my own case, I mean, I wrote in 2013 a biography of Sylvia Plath. That should be enough. It's not. No. I take a look at that biography and it's not, I wouldn't exactly call that biography outdated, but I have new material. And I've also continued to read not only her, but about people of her generation. So I write a second book, The Last Days of Sylvia Plath. And then I realize, and I said this in an earlier podcast, I'm still leaving out a lot of stuff. So then I'm doing two volumes of Sylvia Plath day by day, because the narrative has left out certain, I think, crucial things that you're only going to get in a day by day account. But the problem with the day by day account is that it's not a narrative. It's not an interpretation, although it's allowing the readers to do a kind of interpretation. So now I'm on number five, The Making of Sylvia Plath, because a new archive is opened up. And I've learned some new things about the people involved in her life that have an impact on her. I think that's an example of what happens with biography. Most biographers don't keep at the same subject again and again and again. A few of us do, like me, but most biographers don't. Someone else is going to correct or go beyond what they've done.
And I like to add new material, but also new circumstances.
Yes, yes. The
times are changing. Talking about Sylvia Plath, I'm sure the next biography of Sylvia Plath will contain a lot more about Me Too.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, and, absolutely.
And more and more biographers will ask themselves, what has this person to do with racism or colonialism?
Yes, I'm reading a book now called Gay Faulkner. And the author of the book is not trying to prove that William Faulkner was gay, because there isn't any evidence for William Faulkner being gay. And yet when you read William Faulkner's work, and when you look at the men who's his friends, many of them were gay. And there are gay themes in Faulkner's work. And as I'm reading it, it's like the top of my head is coming off. I've done a two-volume biography, and yet this author of Gay Faulkner, I'm going to have him on my podcast, goes back to really familiar incidents and looks at them. He's also happens to be gay. He begins to look at them in an entirely different way. He talks about Faulkner as almost performing like a gay man in certain parts of his life. Now, some people are going to attack this book for sure. But what it does is it shows you, in a way, how unstable biography is and why biographies of the same subject need to be written.
Yeah. I think that makes biography almost day by day more urgent.
Yeah.
Coming back to the questions Gabriella Kelly Davis
yes.
sent us. She's asking why interpretation, why not giving him many standpoints like in the fiction. I think the clear-cut answer is that readers of biography trust that what they read is true. And I know true and facts are words you can talk in a philosophical way very long, but everyone knows that writing true biography is an ambition. And what makes it more and more urgent is that biography is close to journalism. If you're reading a newspaper, you trust that it's true what you are reading. It's not necessary you agree with it. And the difference with journalism is that an anonymous journalist give all the points of view on the facts, on the fundament of the facts. And a biographer, he is serving his interpretation. As long as it is clear that it's his or her interpretation, it's fine.
Yeah, I can see that.
You see that, for example, Nigel Hamilton, he did a wonderful essay under the title "Biography as a Corrective."
Yeah,
I don't know if this is English, but the biographer is like the louse in the fur.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't feel comfortable for other people because he's not writing a holy life, but he's doing new research and maybe new sources. And there is another story coming out, and this story always hits the reputation of someone.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's right. Let me pose something else here in terms of interpretation. When we read a work of fiction, particularly if it's a first-person narrator, we're going to learn something about that first-person narrator. If we read a novel like The Great Gatsby, we learn about Nick Garraway. We learn about the narrator in Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men, which has an impact on how he looks at the main character in All the King's Men, Willie Stark, and so on. That generally, with the exception of biographies like the Sebald biography, as you say, or as many biographers would say, or feel most comfortable with, they're in a sense they're guides. They're invisible. They're not talking about themselves. Mm-hmm. I've thought about that a lot in doing biographies, and every once in a while in a biography, I feel the need. I don't do it in every biography, but I've done it in several, where I want to give the reader some sense of not just a footnote or, you know, I got this from an interview, but I want to give the reader some sense of how I elicited a certain kind of information through an interview. And so, for instance, in my Lillian Hellman biography, I only do this a few times. I interviewed her lawyer when she was suing the writer Mary McCarthy. And I was intensely interested in what the lawyer was going to do, because I knew that Hellman had lied about certain things, which is what McCarthy was saying.
Yeah.
And was he going to put Hellman on the stand and so on? And he was a close friend of Lillian Hellman's, and he took her lawsuit free, pro bono. She wasn't paying him anything, but he felt so loyal to her. And so I included, it's less than a page, but I included, in a sense, the transcript, part of the way I asked him the questions, which elicited certain reactions about her. And I felt I couldn't just do that in a narrative. I wanted to, in a sense, make the reader present at that moment when I got that information.
Yeah, it's a kind of meta information.
Yeah.
I've done this all the time in the footnote, but sometimes also in the biography itself.
Yeah.
Presenting myself more or less as a movie director. You are using a lot of things, but at the end, it's the movie, it's the director, it's the biographer who's saying this, I go to publish, and not this. So in footnotes, because I published two biographies of poets who had something to do with the Second World War, and that's always very how to say that, there is always a lot of fuss about that. maybe more and more, but that's not a podcast. I put a lot of information of who was telling certain things to me, not by saying, oh, he is lying,
yeah,
but to explain how a figure has a reputation. I give a small example. In Holland, everyone knows a certain poem of a man called Jan Kampert. The name Jan Kampert wasn't that famous, but this poem, everyone. A lot of streets and schools have the first sentence of this poem, and sometimes they write, oh, this is a poem of Jan Kampert. And everyone was thinking it was a poem in the last minutes before he died in a concentration camp. And he is a big resistance reputation.
Mm.
In my biography, I proved, I didn't prove, it's the opposite, but there was something else going on.
Ah.
And so I told the story, but I explained in the footnotes, I won't go too deep in it, but it's hardly possible to be a resistance hero if you are arrested in 1941. And people were really shocked by that because this was their hero. So the story didn't change as far as people knew the story, but the interpretation of how come this man so famous? We have statues, we have everything for him. And as you understand, I lost a lot of friends. but I thought it's important not to debunk this person, but to explain how history and how reputation in the Second World War works.
Yeah.
And this book was published 60 years after the war. But the reactions on the book were like, it all happened yesterday.
Wow, yeah. I think that sometimes readers read into biographies so that when you're uncovering, you know, this evidence, which doesn't match their image of the subject, they think that you're hostile to the subject, which isn't true at all.
No.
But I find that very, very common. Or when with my Rebecca West biography, I was shocked once when I was interviewing someone who knew her, and this was after the book was published, but I was talking to him, and he said, your book proves something that I didn't think could be true. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, I didn't think you could write a biography of someone who you intensely dislike. Well, I didn't.
Yeah. You know,
I was honest in presenting these very dark sides of Rebecca West, but she was an enchanting subject. And the last thing in the world I thought of myself as being was sort of hostile or negative about her. That really surprised me. But I think readers do that. They take that message.
Because people have their own view. I had several times that people told me after one of my books was published, said, oh, Hans, I told you 3 times it's like this, and you write the opposite. So, yes, because you are not my only source.
Yes.
And I just didn't believe it because I had proof it was different.
Yeah, yeah. You get this.
You know what I think is also very important for biography, and not everyone likes it, but that's labeling. So explain what kind of biography you are writing. What's the aim? How did you work? Where does the interpretation start and where does it end? Last week there was a book, an Australian book. So maybe Gabriella will be glad to hear this if she doesn't know it, with the title Speculative Biography.
Yes, I know that book, yeah.
And for some reason, I like it very much because it's so clear. The writers explain very well. Sometimes it's a kind of if history, but they explain very well what they do. And if you do that, you can do everything.
Yeah, yeah, that's very, very interesting. I'm going to get your opinion on one other thing, and then you can tell me what I should have asked you and didn't. I'm going back to the Sebald biography, which I just read and reviewed for the New Criterion. And it's a very good biography in many ways. You get to the end of the biography and you read the acknowledgments. I always read the acknowledgments because I learn a lot about how the biographer worked. Talk about interpretation. Just by the way they thank people or don't thank people or the names on the list or the names not on the list and so on. And one of the things she does is she mentions Sebald's wife. And she mentions that the wife did not want to be interviewed and didn't cooperate. And all through the book, I kept waiting. I knew he had a wife, and the wife is mentioned once or twice, and that's it. There's another review, I didn't know this when I reviewed the book, another review in an American newspaper that said the wife was quite hostile to the biography. I don't know about you, Hans, but if I were in that position with someone like Sebald, and the wife wasn't cooperative, and I was just determined to do the book, I would certainly interview other people about the wife. She would, you know, she would have to be in the book, and she's not in the book at all.
Yeah, because I'm sure you know what they are doing in India with widows. For example, widows of writers or presidents. When the president is dying or the writer is dying, they burn the widow at the same time.
Yeah,
I'm not telling this because this is a good idea, but I understand some frustration of writers. I have two comments on that. First, every biographer should explain to his readers why he chose for the genre biography. You can write wonderful books about writers without writing a biography or a member of parliaments. It's a kind of monography.
Yes.
And I think every biography needs this argument and needs for the reader to be clear. And then I guess the answer on the question, why did he choose for biography, is that private life must be useful for explaining public life. And I'm not talking only about sex and drugs, but just normal personal life must give some interpretation for someone's public life. And in the case of the wife that didn't want to cooperate, I would publish at least four chapters of her. There must be a reason.
Yeah.
That's my first comment. And my second comment is a little bit shorter. Wait for 10 years. When someone died on an average age, let's say 80.
Yes.
Then wait for 10 years before starting writing biography. Because all the friends, the spouses, are dead, and the colleagues are dead, and the archives will grow and are in public places. So writing about a living person is always tricky.
Yeah, I've done it.
I know. Tricky. I know. You slept in his house. I know. make you very happy, I guess, because there was a lot of critique on that book. I found it a wonderful book.
Yes. Yes. Well, I guess I have a tough skin. I've done it more than once and they can attack me all they want. I think there's certain advantages. This is another podcast. I'm not going to go into this now, but
no.
I think there are certain advantages about living on a living figure and disadvantages about waiting till they're dead. But I take your point for sure.
Some people think that biography is meant to learn something or to make the world better or giving honor to certain people. None of that, I believe in it. The biographer has only his responsibility to his task and role as a biographer.
Yeah.
You hear very often about ethical sides of writing biography. Can you use this and can you use that? And I like to tell always to people who want to hide certain things that the things they want to hide, they get the most attention. You know, in the United States, Warren Harding, he could be president, people say, in 1916, but his mistress said, no, if you are running for president, I will open our correspondence. And in halfway the 60s, 40, 50 years later, the family didn't want a biographer using these letters.
Yes.
What's the result? That a small professor in Groningen, in the north of the Netherlands, is talking only about these letters. And that's always the same.
Yeah.
If people don't like you publish something, that's just a part, even if you would listen to that, that's the part that people like to talk of. And second, it's always about the same Carol.
Yes.
It's always a mistress or someone did some very human things. That's life.
Yes.
Probably England is an exception. If you're looking to the British press, they are going always a little bit further. Member of Parliament, like of biographies of members of Parliament, are very often a kind of Jerry Springer show. It's not only a mistress, but also strangling sex and pedophily and other things. But not, in most circumstances, those things are not very, very interesting, but you have to know everything to make your own choice and to make
That's
your
right.
own interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that for sure. Yeah. So should I have asked you something else?
Yeah. Now to ask you, I like to say maybe direct to Gabriella, because she is quoting Ira Nadel, Black Snyder, in her mail to us. And I would say every biography has at least three perspectives. And then you will see interpretation is necessary. The first perspective is the reconstruction of the self. That's very important. Sometimes you don't have too much material, but letters and diaries are important. And the second perspective is the reaction of a certain person of contemporary people or contemporary journals or books. And the most important perspective is the interpretation of the biography. So it's a kind of declaration. I want to end it.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's good. That's a good conclusion. Better than mine.
What is your conclusion?
I don't. All I could say about biography is it's incomplete and ever expanding.
You know what? I will end with another one. Better than mine and yours. It's from William Somerset Maugham. A lot of biographers know those rules. Somerset Maugham, he was a novelist, but Richard Holmes, there he is again. He used this for biography. He said, there are only three rules for writing good biography. But no one knows those rules.
That's a good ending. Thank you, Hans.
Okay. Thank you.
I will post this podcast soon and send you a link.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
We'll do this again sometime.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.